You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
All we want is all the income you make over and above your basic break-even fees, and all the stuff you can earn, you pay for the mortgage, and that's the American dream.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Unwelcome guests, I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we're going to look at what economist Michael Hudson has called the new serfdom. Because 90% of the population carries perpetual debt, which they pay to support the wealth of the top 10%. Politicians and pundits tell people that education is the key to economic prosperity. But for many people without means, this is where they fall into the first debt trap. To get an education, they must borrow. And thanks to the collusion of politicians and bankers, many are trapped in a vicious downward spiral. We'll hear about that in our second hour. If they escape that trap, the mortgage on a vastly inflated home price awaits them. In our first hour, we'll hear from Dr. Michael Hudson on how financiers use debt to get a free lunch and how the rest of us are on the menu. John Taylor Gatto readings will return next week due to time constraints.
We soon will be riding my shiny black.
Michael Hudson is president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's worked as a Wall Street analyst and as an economic consultant to national governments. He's the author of many books, including The Economic Strategy of American Empire, The Myth of Aid, and Global Fracture, The New International Economic Order. The talk we're about to hear was given 3 months ago at Raritan Community College in New Jersey. Dr. Michael Hudson.
Well, I'm primarily a financial economist, but real estate bubbles are primarily financial bubbles. 70% of all the bank loans in America and in England are made for real estate mortgages. So the banking system and the financial system is based on real estate. Primarily. Most American savings are invested in real estate because the savings go into banks or insurance companies that turn around and pump them into real estate. So when you're talking about real estate bubble, you're not only talking about the financial growth, and in every country, the growth of savings is exponential, largely because the growth of debt is exponential. And one person's savings is another's debts. So when you put your savings in a bank, or when you pay insurance policies for life insurance or health insurance, or when you make other kinds of payments, most of this ends up being recycled into the real estate market, and that's one of the major dynamics that's been pushing up real estate prices for the last 20 years. The other thing you need for a real estate bubble is government support. Every financial bubble in the world since the South Sea bubble in England in the 1710s has been created by government. And governments created this bubble as a deliberate policy. This was what Mr. Greenspan called wealth creation. The policy of Mr. Greenspan is that when people's balance sheets rise, when the assets they have are larger than their debts, then that's wealth creation. And The opposite side of the argument is what Mr. Greenspan and the Federal Reserve call wealth creation is, on the other balance sheet, side of the balance sheet, debt creation. Just like assets equal liabilities, savings equal debt, so that as the real estate prices and bubble go up, people's debt go up. And in fact, right now, most Americans have to spend their lives working off the high mortgages that they have to take on in order to buy property that's more expensive. So that while you have the financial sector and the Federal Reserve and the government saying they're against inflation, the fact is America has seen the most rapid inflation of any country in history in the last 20 years. But what's been inflated is the access price to housing, the access price to commercial office space, and basically the price of land. And that's considered a very good thing in comparison to the kinds of inflation that the government doesn't like. They don't like it when your wages go up. They call that wage inflation. They don't like it when prices go up. They call that price inflation. But they love asset price inflation. And they have a way of stopping the bad inflation, your wages, of going up. They have more and more of your income being set aside for the bottom 90% of the population to pay interest charges so that people don't have to bid up prices by buying goods and services. And right now you're having the economy cut back on goods and services, cut back on spending, basically to pay the debts that they've taken on for real estate that's now going no longer rising in value. Now, a month ago I was in Chicago actually having lunch with my oldest client, and they're sort of used to all of us being contrarian since the 1960s. And he said, well, finally somebody who's going to tell us why the real estate is going to be a great buy. And I said, I can't figure out any reason. He said, but once everybody, the contrarian philosophy is that once everybody comes to agree on where markets are going, it's probably an outdated view and they're wrong. But the fact is that every banker I know, every mortgage banker, every financial analyst, everybody can only see prices going down from here. None of us could find a single person or even a single argument for why prices would continue to go up. So I'm going to explain why there's that pessimism and why, indeed, the bubble's really over, and why Mr. Greenspan decided to get out just at the right time. And in fact, to read his last speeches before the Federal Reserve Board, it was like, after me the deluge, saying he knows that it can't go on much longer. And you don't hear much from him these days because television has become pretty much entertainment, and they don't think that this is entertaining news for most of you. People like to hear who's won the lottery. They like to hear good news about prices going up, although it's bad news for anybody who has to buy a house. But they basically don't want to hear the news that it's all over. And so you have basically what's in the news missing a lot of the points on what the dynamics of the real estate market are, both the financial dynamics and the government dynamics, and now as of this week, the balance of payments dynamics, which actually you can expect the next year's real estate prices to be a function of America's balance of payments deficit as the dollar plunges, forcing the country to raise interest rates. It's going to essentially be more of a guillotine than you just saw when the wall slid. Well, you know there's a real estate bubble when two conditions apply. The first condition is that everybody has to expect prices to keep on rising. That means that they don't pay much attention to the price they actually pay for a building, or if they buy a rental property, they don't care that much about what the income of the property is. All they think is whatever the price they pay is, they're going to make more money the next year. Mathematical economists have figured out formulas for this. That's how you get promoted in academia. And the formula is if the expected price rise, the delta P, is larger than the rate of interest, in other words, if the price goes up 6% and you only have to pay a mortgage of 5%, you're going to make money off the property, especially because capital gains taxes are taxed much lower than earned income. The second condition is that the carrying charge of a property has to be larger than the rental income it generates. In other words, you know there's a bubble. When you buy a house, you have to pay, say, $1,000 a month in real estate taxes and maintenance charges and mortgage, and you're only getting $900 in rent. And in fact, for the last 3 years, that's been the case in the American economy. People were buying houses and actually subsidizing the tenants because they said, it's okay taking a loss. We're going to lose $100 a month in subsidizing the tenants because the property's going up $200 a month in appreciation, so it actually pays us to lose money because we're going to come out okay in the end. And that's only okay if you can get out in time, which most people didn't do because there's never any way of foreseeing exactly when the bubble will end. You know that it will end, but you never know when this is going to be. Again, the economists have a definition of equilibrium for real estate prices. And equilibrium is, if you're thinking of buying a house, you calculate what you're going to have to pay in rent every month. Suppose you have to pay $1,000 in rent, and you go to the bank, and you can find a way of buying a house and only paying $1,000 in mortgage amortization, interest, and taxes, and the heating, then you think, gee, I might as well buy the house because then I get the free ride of the price going up. And someday, actually, that's how most Americans have got rich. Most American families have the largest asset in real estate. They bought it at a fraction of what it's going for today, and that's how the previous generation got rich in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and even the 70s. For all of you who are under the age of 50, you've missed out and you can't do it again. Your parents did, but they're going to take a vacation and use all of their money and you're not going to get it, and you're really going to be in trouble because the free lunch is over. At the university I went to as an undergraduate, the University of Chicago, Milton Friedman there made this absolutely ridiculous statement, and if any of your professors ever make it, you should just ignore him. The statement Milton Friedman said is there is no such thing as a free lunch. The fact is, the economy is all about getting a free lunch. If it isn't free, it's not worth getting because everybody else is getting a free lunch. So why would anybody say there isn't a free lunch when most Americans have gotten rich on asset price inflation, of the house going up, on stock market speculation, when you see the billionaires all getting rich without having to produce any goods and services? Well, the only people that say there isn't a free lunch are the people who are getting it. And they don't want you to know because then they don't want the government to know because of reporting to the tax authorities. They'd have to actually pay taxes on it. So anyone who says there isn't a free lunch, you know, has his hand in somebody's pocket and is getting it. And in fact, these are the people not only who are running the governments, they're the people who make the real estate statistics. Most of my work in real estate is as a statistician. And in every country we go to, for instance, Jeff and I have written a series of newspaper articles in Latvia for the Latvians. We've looked at the Latvian real estate statistics. By the way, in Latvia, there's over a 70% flat tax on labor, less than 1% tax on property. And if you look at the assessments on property, the assessments are less than 10% of the actual market value. Over here, it's even worse. America is not even up to Latvian standards. If you look at the Federal Reserve reports for the value of all commercial property, take the most recent statistic for which the Fed actually broke out, land as opposed to buildings. Suppose everybody, and the government would come and they're going to say, we will give you all the land owned by every corporation in the United States. On what conditions would you take this land? What do you imagine all the land of every corporation in America is worth according to the Federal Reserve Bank? Anybody have any idea?
Many trillions.
Many trillions? According to the Federal Reserve, it's negative $4 billion. In other words, the value of buildings exceeds the value of land, so we will give you all the land in America and $4 billion if you'll only take it over. And that's because the tax laws are written to essentially is a giveaway to the real estate interests, who, hardly by surprise, are among, along with the banking system, the largest contributors to political campaigns. And according to the government tax laws, you're allowed to depreciate a building again and again and again at any price. And the depreciation of a building makes such assumptions that the building is worth actually more than the land. And every once in a while, the English language, which, by the way, the English language is the richest language in the world. But every once in a while, it's necessary to add a few words to the language because they're still growing. In the 1950s, the word was overkill. You remember, that was a new word, and that meant when you drop an atomic bomb, after you kill a population once, how many times do you have to kill them to measure the atomic weaponry that you have? So overkill came into the language. In the last decade, they've added a similar word, over-depreciation, and that is when you write off a building as if it's all worn out, and then you sell it either to another company that you have or to a friend for his building. You can depreciate the same building over and over and over again. And the same building in Manhattan must have been depreciated 15 or 20 times. The rate of depreciation that landlords take for the real estate industry as a whole, if you look at the national income accounts and you look at the real estate industry, the effective tax rate on real estate owners is zero because the entire income of the real estate industry is absorbed by interest payments to the bank and depreciation. So the idea is that they're actually losing money on these buildings at the same time that the Federal Reserve says that the $11 trillion that America has in real estate is all buildings. The tax laws assume that there is no building appreciation at all, and in fact the buildings are all wearing out. So the statistics are absolutely the reverse of economic reality, but they're when you find statistics doing this, you find that there's always a reason, and the reason is to provide the free lunch to the real estate sector. Now, this has led people, especially in America, to criticize landlords for the last few hundred years. And in the late 19th century, for instance, Henry George was criticizing landlords as parasites and taking everything, just like the British landlords. The Vikings invaded England, seized the land, and made everybody pay rent. But the fact is that, if you look at the national income statistics, the landlords don't get the rent of the land in America. And that's the second thing you have to realize. There's a phrase in the real estate investment business, rent is for paying interest. If you want to buy a building and get rich, you want to put as little of your money as possible in the building. You want to borrow the money, and that really gives you the free lunch because it's not your money, it's the bank's money if it goes up. And you can always do what Donald Trump is and walk away from it. So what happens is that as people bid against each other to buy an office building or to buy an apartment building, the winner at this auction who is able to outbid the others for the price is the person who's willing to take all of the rent, pay it to the bank for the interest. The real estate investors are not into making income off their property like people thought in the 100 years ago and is still being taught in the textbooks of some universities. They're in it for the capital gain. So the real estate industry has made a deal with the banking system. We'll give you all the income from the rent, and we get to keep the capital gain at the end, if there is any. Well, around about last March, things reached pretty much of a crisis. In Chicago, I talked to some community bankers who lent money to essentially commercial developers. And they said they can't understand how anyone can make money off buying buildings because they are promising to pay these bankers more than the rent roll is. How can they do it? There's only one way they can do it. In Chicago, unlike Manhattan, you're allowed to tell everybody, get out of the building, we're emptying it out, and we're turning it into condos. So what they did in Chicago was you'd borrow the money to buy a building, tell everybody to move out, empty it out, and then try to sell it at a price where if you add up the prices of all the condos you divide it into, after paying the lawyer to do all of this, you come out with a capital gain, you repay the bank, and then you keep what's left over. Well, unfortunately, they found out that there's no more money, that nobody's around to buy, so now they're suddenly turning around and are trying to re-rent these properties, and they're defaulting. Well, you'd think the bank would lose money, but the bankers don't care because they already knew that these people couldn't make money. And they would make loans at about 5.5%. And they could borrow money at about 4%. And then for 0.75%, they could buy default insurance from the insurance companies. So you have the large American insurance industry that's been underwriting all these banks' loans that if the mortgages go bad, the banks won't lose anything, the insurance company are going to pay. The insurance companies then take this 0.75%, and they get this 0.75% just for signing a lie on the piece of paper, I'm going to pay you if anything goes wrong, and they sell it all mainly to pension funds. So the pension funds of people are invested in the insurance policies to the banks to make the bad loans to help people bid up the price of buildings so that the employees who are contributing to the pension funds have to pay higher prices to get a home and work even more of their lives, work overtime, take you have three-job families right now, all to afford the price of the home that Mr. Greenspan says is wealth creation. So the economy, instead of having a leisure society, is working harder and harder. It's really the indebted society because the house price is very large debt. And thinking that somehow they are going to get richer if the capital gain comes in, but now they're not getting a capital gain. And in fact, what they realize is that the last 20 years have been a huge hook on to get people to buy property on, let's say, easy terms. For instance, you had the prices just about double for real estate in the last, at least double in the last 10 years. This has been a purely financial manipulation. It doesn't mean people have more money to spend on housing. It means that prices have doubled without people actually having to pay more of their paycheck every month. And this has happened in a number of ways. One way is that Alan Greenspan flooded the market with so much credit that interest rates have gone way down. Interest rates on a mortgage were 15% in 1980 at the peak. That's right when Volcker was and Carter were trying to stop the inflation in America. And it's why Ronald Reagan got elected primarily, because people were couldn't afford to buy housing. There, New York City had almost gone bankrupt in 1974. By the way, the value of New York City real estate is larger than the value of all of the plant and equipment in America. So people talk about we're being in an industrial economy. We're basically a real estate economy, and some economists make a euphemism for this, a post-industrial society. But actually, you could call it a neo-feudal society, because feudal society used to be land and usury. And we're going back. What we're seeing in America is a retrogression away from the industrial mode of production to the old rent and interest production, where instead of industrial wealth, you're having more and more of the economy actually take the form of real estate wealth, of increasing the prices of all of property already in place. And partly this is because of the way in which the banking system is structured in America and England. Banks, in some textbooks, you see a bank will lend money to an industrialist to buy machinery, to hire labor, to make savings, to put into a bank. This is what they call the circular flow. The only place you find this kind of circular flow is in a toilet bowl. You don't find it in economics. No bank in America makes loans to put in place plant and equipment. That's not legal under the banking system. A bank can only make money by making a loan that has collateral. And the collateral either is going to be a building or a company or a stock or a bond. They don't make money for someone to develop something. Henry Ford couldn't get the money from banks to build the car. James Watt, when he invented the steam engine, couldn't get the money from any bank. Blue sky thinking. Almost all the main innovators in the last few hundred years of the Industrial Revolution had to use their own savings or borrow the money from the family to get it, or from friends, because banks just don't only lend money against the property in place. So the effect of all this bank credit and all of people's savings is essentially to increase the price of property in place or stocks and bonds that are already outstanding. So that as the credit increased, as people's savings increased, so much money was available in the economy that the interest rates came down, and at 5% interest, you're able to carry a mortgage that was three times as high as when you had to pay 15% interest. Now, banks began to, because most of their income comes from mortgage lending, they vied with each other in order to get customers. And in addition to lowering the interest rates, they'd borrow from the Federal Reserve and lend it out. They would make it easier for people to borrow and carry a mortgage. One way they'd make it easier was to say, you don't have to pay amortization. That is, you don't have to really pay off the mortgage. Banks don't ever want people to repay debts, just like credit cards. People who pay their credit cards every month are called freeloaders by the banks because they don't pay the late fees. They don't pay all the fees that generate half of the bank's credit card money apart from the interest they charge. So the banks have it used to be that mortgages for homes were stretched out over 30 years and you'd make your payment every month of your interest, but mortgage payment would have a little bit of amortization, and at the end of 30 years, say you begin working at buying the house at 30, by the time you retire around 60, you'll have paid off your mortgage and then can let the kids fight it over who gets the house or whatever they do. But the banks, beginning about 5 years ago, they stretched out the mortgages to 40 years. And finally, about 3 years ago, they've made interest-only mortgages. In other words, you don't pay any amortization. It's an infinity duration mortgage. You no matter how much you pay, you never work it off. All we want is all the income you make over and above your basic break-even fees, and all the stuff you can earn, you pay for the mortgage, and that's the American dream. It used to be people would pay 20% down. If you bought a house for $100,000, you'd have to put $20,000 in. The banks, as of last year, now about half of the new mortgage loans didn't require any money down at all. And certainly for the big real estate developers like Donald Trump, they'd never put their own money in. Often they'd be having money that they would handle as a fiduciary relationship. They'd find somebody else to put it up. So you could buy houses with no money down, so makes it even easier. And finally, they would give you especially low interest rates and say, we'll give you, like it for credit cards, we'll give you an introductory rate, and then we'll set the rate according to what interest rates are doing in the economy. These are called adjustable rate mortgages, or ARMs. And most mortgages written in the last few years have been these adjustable rates. For instance, in the condominium where I live in Forest Hills in New York, we were able to borrow at 1% over LIBOR. In other words, at 2.5% some years ago to put windows in the building. 2.5% is very low. But now that Europe is raising its interest rates, all of a sudden, we have to pay is finally beginning to go up. And as a matter of fact, you may have noticed in the last week that the American dollar is plunging. When a currency plunges, the only way of stabilizing it is to raise the interest rates. In fact, what you had happen this morning was that the European community, being very self-destructive, raised its interest rates because it said inflation is up to 2%, and there are actually some people that are getting work, and we need to have what used to be called the reserve army of the unemployed. We need enough unemployment to keep wages down. So just to make sure that there's no more employment now that you folks have elected a right-wing government in Germany, we're going to raise the interest rates to make sure that nobody's going to invest or hire you, so that there can be more wealth creation, and we know that you'll be very happy to see that people are getting very rich off this, so we're going to raise the interest rates so it's more economical to employ labor at a lower rate, and the labor unions won't be pushing up the prices you have to pay, which is pretty silly because in Europe they're basically doing what they're doing here and buying Chinese goods, so it doesn't make any difference what they're paying anyway, but Europe raised the rate today. The the dollar plunged again, and either you're going to have to pay twice as much for your imports next year. As a matter of fact, the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Paulson, is going to China next week to say, raise your currency, raise your prices of Chinese labor so that Americans will have to pay more for the imports, on the theory that somehow the Americans are going to get into the paper flower business and all the other businesses of manufacturing, as if they hadn't already dismantled all the manufacturing that was happening over here. So although we've gone into the post-industrial society, we somehow think that China's competition for all of this, and they're trying to get the Chinese currency to go up, which is going to raise all of the prices, and the Fed is going to then say there's an inflation, we're going to have to raise the interest rates more in order to stop the inflation. That's going to have all of these homeowners that have got the adjustable rate mortgages all of a sudden having to pay more of their, even more of their income, and they'd already pledged all the income they could get. They were told by the newspapers, buy the most expensive house you can get because it's all going up, and the higher the house you pay for, it's the more you're going to make. Now all of a sudden they're finding that they're faced with either having to cut back on their living expenses, cut back on their food, or they'll default on the mortgages. Now, the amazing thing, if you go to Europe, you realize what a really dysfunctional society can be like after 20 years. In England, where I spend a lot of time, I've noticed that the English people don't invite you to their house anymore for dinner. And it's not either they don't like you, but I find other people also are not invited. They're really embarrassed because they don't have enough money to feed you any meat, because they can't afford it. And they can't afford it because England's had an even more rapid housing price inflation than the United States. They're all strapped. And this is the basic reason why a bubble has to end, whether it's in the United States or England or anywhere else. When you have asset prices go up, it means people have to pay more and more for the carrying charges on the debts taken on to buy the assets. But as they have to pay more and more, they have less and less left over to buy goods and services, and that leads to deflation in what used to be called the real economy, the production and consumption sector. And what you find when you're doing an analysis is there are actually two economies. There's the production and consumption economy that you read about in the textbooks, and there's the property and finance economy, real estate, finance, and insurance. The national income economists have an acronym for this called the FIRE sector, and FIRE for finance, insurance, and real estate. And the better this sector is doing, the worse the rest of the economy is doing. This is compound interest. Any interest rate can be expressed as a doubling time. The interest rate will lead, if you put the money in the bank, they'll say you can double it. If it's 10%, it compounds in about 7 years. If it's 5%, it takes about 15 years. This is called the magic of compound interest. And it's magic because it's a purely mathematical function. It has nothing to do with the economy's ability to pay. If you look at the savings of any country or the national debt of any country, they all follow the same curve. However, real economies grow in S-curves. They go up and then they turn down in business cycles. That's why they call it a business cycle. The debt service exceeds the amount of money that's due. We're in the state now where the money owed by large sections of the population exceeds the ability to pay. What you have is the top map there is Japanese real estate prices. They went up until about 1990, and then America went to Japan, and they asked the Japanese, will you commit economic suicide and destroy your economy to help elect the Republicans again? And the Japanese said, yes, we love America. We're going to destroy our economy. We're going to increase the suicide rate, increase the death rate, increase the alcoholism rate, and bankrupt ourselves in order to help reelect the Republican candidate. The result is that year after year, every single quarter, for the next 20 years, Japanese real estate prices have been plunging downwards. When you you look at the statistics that Japan has, they make very detailed statistics of exactly what prices are going up and down. You may have read in around 1985, the land, the Ginza area, right around the Royal Palace of Tokyo, was worth more than all the land in the entire state of California. That's because the Japanese are very patriotic and they believe in investing all their money at home. And if you have the compound interest of all of the Japanese export earnings all going into real estate lending, of course you're going to have this curve of savings all on the given amount of land. Of course you're going to have a big boom. And then they stopped it. They raised the interest rates in order to stabilize the currency, bankrupted the real estate people. The large investors walked away. And you had a decline in the prices of land that have gone down the most seriously in Japan are the richest land. The more expensive the property, the larger the downturn was. The rural land never went up that much, and it hasn't gone down. The same thing is probably happening here, but you don't have statistics on high-valued properties or low-valued properties. Last spring, so many people thought that they could make money on real estate that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which sells indexed futures for copper and commodities, thought that they were going to start a real estate index. So they called me over and said, "Why don't you know? Would you put together the sales package for this real estate index? We'll get rich in no time." And what we found was that there wasn't any good real estate index. The U.S. government, they were going to have real estate indexes for every city, Miami, New York, I think even New Jersey was in there. But the problem is that the area there wasn't any way of distinguishing. For instance, in Miami, you have a lot of Latin American, they call it flight capital. It's really cocaine capital, but the polite word is flight capital. And the Latin Americans came in and built up all of Miami's downtown with huge condominiums. They're all empty. You go to Florida because you want to be near the seashore. You don't want to be in downtown Miami and get mugged at night. But there are all these empty condominiums built by Latin American millionaires, basically. So you have these all in the same index as beachfront properties and everything else. We find we couldn't get a reasonable kind of property index. And in fact, if you've looked at the headlines in the last few months, it said, well, property prices are... property is staying much longer on the market, but the prices are still inching up in Boston and New York. This is all basically fictitious. It's a statistic that doesn't make sense. And what happens is that because the most expensive properties turn down first, you're having people, the speculators who've bought these big expensive properties, bail out. They're selling at a big loss the more expensive properties. People from the working class and the middle class who bought homes to live in, they can't afford to sell. They're just holding on to their property and are just selling it. So all of a sudden, the kinds of homes that are being selling isn't the same mix of homes from poor to rich. You're having the rich people sell, the poor people frozen in, locked into negative equity, thinking what must go up, what must go down has to come up again. They have this idea that it's all a cycle. And somehow, if you just are patient enough, it's all going to turn out all right in the end. They're like lemmings. People who have a faith in the future usually end up losing all of their money. They're the people the financial sector makes its money off of. They're the people who tell the news broadcasters, your audience wants to hear good news, you know, knowing that if there are enough suckers out there who believe the good news, there's going to be plenty of money to be made off of them, which is another reason why you're not going to get this kind of analysis on the news broadcast particularly. So the average family is holding on to the house. The rich people are dumping it all. Last year, 14% of all the houses in America that were bought by speculators. It was the speculators as 14% of the buyers who were forcing up the market. They're out of the market completely now. They're not buying, and with the 14% out, there's not the demand to buy. The prices are going down. The people who've bought the highest priced properties are dumping them, and the more they dump them, the more the price indexes go up, because the price indexes consist mainly of the expensive property. So that explains the kind of paradox that you'll find in statistics. For all of you who think of economics as an empirical science, this makes it very difficult to do any kind of mathematical modeling, given the kind of statistics that America makes compared to the ones that you would get in a country like Japan. The key is that most people don't sense what's happening because they think that they still think of society the way it's projected in the economics textbooks, where they'll talk about the real economy. Or if you're looking at the newspaper, they talk about real wages, meaning they deflate everything by money. When people use the word real, that's a euphemism for unreal. None of you think of your wages in terms of what it would be if it were deflated by some price index. You think of what you're getting in terms of money and what you have to spend. The government statistics calls reality a kind of science fiction world. Well, what if there weren't any inflation and there were no financial sector and it was all the economy or only production and consumption that didn't have any property, didn't have any speculation, and didn't have any finance? That's not how the world works, and it's not even how it worked in antiquity. You know that there's a kind of a fiction going on there. There are a couple of fictions that I think I do want to discuss. Almost all, I stopped teaching economics basically in 1972 when it was obvious that the best students that I'd had at that time went into economics because they wanted to see how the world worked. And instead, they found that the curriculum, the price theory textbooks, and the other textbooks were more like a parallel universe of how the world would work if it worked very nicely and everybody got repaid according to how much they produced and their enterprise. All of this was a kind of fiction that was developed about 100 years ago as an alternative to classical economics, when classical economics turned into Henry George and Marx and people that talked about property that a lot of the families who funded and endowed universities didn't find very pleasant. So the first fiction is that that rising property prices somehow reflect prosperity, and if houses are going up, that means everybody's getting richer. It doesn't at all. It means that people are going further and further into debt, and the real estate bubble tends to make the richest people and the richest of all, but it obliges the home buyers to pay more and more of their income to afford this property that's going up. It really inflates their expenses. And you may have noticed every quarter now when the statistics come out, the papers say Americans are saving zero. There's a zero savings rate now, which has been. How many of you have seen these newspaper reports? These are, again, utterly fictitious. America's saving more than it has ever saved before. There are gigantic savings. Unfortunately, all of these savings are done by the richest 10% in the United States. These savings that they're doing are lent out to the bottom 90%. And because when they report the savings rate, they don't talk about gross savings. They talk about net savings, savings less debt. And they say, well, wait a minute, if savings are balanced by debt, then there's no savings. So that whereas America used to recycle its savings into building factories, plant and equipment to employ people, now the savings are not going into factories and employing people here. They're going into Chinese factories. They're going into foreign factories, but they're not going into American factories. All of the savings in America by the richest 10% are now lent out to the bottom 90%, mainly to buy houses. You have savings and debt growing without any growth in the means of production, without any growth in earning income. And in fact, the take-home earnings of the average American worker is now lower than it was in 1979. So actual living standards are actually going down at the time that savings are supposed to be going up. Because the government doesn't break down who's doing the saving and who's doing the indebtedness and where the savings are going, this isn't picked up by the reports. This week, I helped draft a law that Dennis Kucinich is putting into Congress to call for better reporting on most of these savings, which would actually trace it. As you can imagine, this is not going to be a very popular law, and all of the lobbying of the financial sector and the real estate sector will probably be a second. The second is that growth in mortgage debt can somehow, the bubble can keep going if the Fed just keeps expanding the policy. But it really can't, because there's a minimum to which interest rates can be lowered. The minimum's about 5.5%. That was reached last year. They can't go any lower because of the price, not only the price of raising money, but because of the buying the default insurance has gone up, and because of balance of payments consideration. If America avoids a real estate bubble by keeping the interest rates low, you can expect prices, the dollar, to plunge to such a degree that it will become a banana currency, and you're all going to have to pay twice as much for the goods and services that you import, meaning your cars and anything you buy at Walmart, which is made in China. So the price of maintaining the real estate bubble is essentially to double your living costs, which, of course, will not give families enough money to pay their mortgages anyway. So no matter what the real estate bubble is going to burst, just on balance of payments grounds. Another myth is that all of these price rises for buildings are justified because of the replacement cost of buildings. But what really has to be replaced, the idea is that buildings somehow grow in value over time. But buildings don't grow in value. Buildings wear out. What grows in market price is the land, and that's created by nature, not by building. And in fact, the depreciation statistics I mentioned before are explain most of this. And so the final myth is that something I've been discussing all along, that the government statistics provide an accurate profile of what's happening in the economy. The fact is that wealth tends to make itself invisible to all of society, as well as to the tax collector, and especially to economics students. So that, the economic theory you have, hardly any economic theory anywhere focuses on real estate. The economic theory that people are taught generally acts as if we're still in an industrial economy rather than in a primarily a real estate economy, which is what we're in. And it's because it's a real estate economy that we're facing the kind of financial crisis that we're facing. And at this point, I'd better begin to take the questions, because I think I've gone awfully fast in 45 minutes.
You're listening to a talk by economist Michael Hudson. The question period follows, and unfortunately, the questions were off mic, so I'll restate a summary of what was asked. The first question was whether interest rates will go higher or lower.
They can't go lower because the interest rate by almost every country is set by how do you stabilize the currency rate. And America was able to lower the interest rate because foreign governments were recycling all of the U.S. dollars back into the into Treasury bills. Now, what that means is that many of you have read in a paper that the war in Iran has cost $1 trillion. All of the war in Iran has been Iraq. I'm just like Mr. Baker.
Yes,
yeah, that's right. Long day. The war in Iraq. next month, Iran. This month, Iraq. Asia has financed all of America's foreign military spending. And now that today President Bush said his intention to attack Iran with atomic weapons imminently, you can expect the rest of the world. Bush today, if you didn't see it, rejected totally the report and said he will not talk to Iran until Iran offers unconditional surrender, disarms, lets the Sunnis massacre all of the Shiites in Iraq, and there are a couple of other conditions for absolute surrender. This is absolute nonsense. And Mr. Blair stood next to him applauding, saying, well, of course, we think it's wonderful that America is making these sacrifices. Of course, we're pulling out all the British troops. So it was one of the more surrealistic press conferences on record. But you can be sure that the rest of the world is pulling their money out of America because they don't want to be blown up by the United States with the war that was announced today. So the interest rates are not going to go. To answer the question, the interest rates cannot go down because of balance. Other countries are now dumping their dollars, and the dollar's plunged. Foreign countries have been financing the government. They're not doing it. They're pulling the plug on America, and it's now going the way of the Latin American peso.
Will the prices of homes ever go down?
Yes, they're already going down. On the homes you have, they're going down. But the index may show that prices are going up. As the rich people sell their homes and you hold on to your home, it's going to make an appearance that the average sale of a price of a home is going up. But all that means is that expensive homes are being sold, not the inexpensive homes.
What will real estate be doing in 5 years?
Nobody can really tell right now. The banks themselves don't know. It's not very good. Nobody really thinks of what's going to happen in 5 years. I know there are a lot of people that say, okay, I'll lose all the money now. I'll just leave the money in the market, let it go down 90%. It'll come back, and you know, I'm holding it for the long term. Before it gets to the long term, you're wiped out. It's like the Pentagon devised a missile, an intercontinental missile, in 1965, and it could get all the way to Russia. But what they found out, here's the horizon. Before it got to Russia, it went underground, made a U-turn, went underground, and then went up. And of course, once it goes underground, it stops and never gets to Russia. And we're in that kind of a mathematical curve. Rental markets are pretty good. You have all these people holding on to the buildings. They're desperate. They don't want to sell the building. And so they think, how am I ever going to pay the mortgage? They're desperate to rent. And the irony in all of this boom is that while the real estate prices of homes were going up, the rents were going down because you had so many speculators come in buying houses. They thought, how on earth, now that we bought it, how do we make the mortgage pay? And so all this property that used to be sold to homeowners is now sold to speculators and rented out to people. So the rental property increased at the same time that the property boom happened, and you had the higher the house price, the lower the rent. Basically, what you have, this is a negative equity, what you have is when the mortgage debt charges are here, the price of a mortgage home goes down. This is a negative equity. We're going into the negative equity, and that can, you notice I don't have any years on that. That's the condition that we're in. Nobody knows how long it's going to be because once there's because the whole economy is real estate, when the economy begins to go down, there's a danger of a total collapse.
What should people do who have a home and want to raise a family?
You might as well keep it and use it. There's no. I know some people think, boy, I'm going to be real smart. I'll sell now, and then I'm going to buy it back in a few years. But that's a real hassle. Yeah, a real hassle. If you're going to raise a family in it, then just keep what you have, hold it for the long term, and just ignore all this stuff.
What should you do if you have cash?
I have my cash in a CD. In a bank, just a certificate of deposit earning interest. I don't have almost every money manager I know doesn't have any money in the stock market, doesn't have money in real estate. I don't have a mortgage. None of us know what to do, and we can't think of anything better than having it in cash. And if we had to pay 5.5% for a mortgage, we know that we can't make 5.5% risk-free. So we'd rather just have it in cash. If you have extra cash, pay off the mortgage. Get as much out of debt as you can. I'd pay it off as quick as you can to lower risk, because you never know when you're going to be fired. And a lot of people say, well, okay, but a lot of people say that they're one paycheck at home away from bankruptcy. And Alan Greenspan gave a speech a few years ago where he said the housing boom has cured the labor union problem in this country, because workers are afraid to go on strike, because if they go on strike, they'll miss their mortgage payment, and then they'll lose the house. Isn't that wonderful? Now we have wages going down while prices are going up. It's utopia. So basically, you want to minimize your risk. And I'm not a risk taker. Be ready to turn on a dime.
Isn't it true that the downturn is isolated to some places?
Yes, it's only in America and Europe and South America and Asia. It's not in it hasn't hit the Baltic states yet. Well, San Francisco's still going up. There's some places that have particular limitations or quirky taxes system. So, in a few places, there's a when you're buying a house, you're really buying a tax write-off. Homeowners, real estate speculators, as I said, don't have to pay income tax, because owning a property with a building on it is like owning an oil well. You pretend it's losing its value, and you take the depreciation as if that's a loss, and you count it against your income. So essentially, you're reporting a loss. But basically, the property is going down everywhere except a few places like San Francisco. It's even going down in Las Vegas now. Been in residential houses and property, too. It's pretty much across the board. You can get the National Association of Realtors has on their website has the indexes for every city in the United States, and you can follow what every city is doing from the NAR, National Association of Realtors index, which is the least bad index that you can find right now, better than the government indexes. But they show it's going down pretty much everywhere. Or if businesses buy something to make an income, they are able to buy the property by borrowing a mortgage that totally absorbs all of the income. In other words, the rent is for paying interest to the bank. So it's one thing if a university does with an endowment, but most people, that's not, the average American isn't a university. Businesses as a whole pay all of the interest from all of the income to the bank as interest. They buy it. The name of the game is capital gains, not income. That doesn't mean that there are some ways of making income off property, but not as much income as you'd make elsewhere. If you want income, you get it a different way. Capital gains are much more attractive. They call that total returns. And it used to be people would see income, and all of classical analysis is based on making profits. That's not the fact now. Now, they wanted to make rent, and then they wanted to make capital gains. So now income isn't the objective. Capital gains were the objective, and that game is over now. If it's better to buy a house, is it better to wait or buy now? If prices are going down, you want to wait, unless you don't like to freeze in the cold and don't have a place to live and can't find an apartment. So, of course, you can probably go to an auction and get a distressed deal. One friend of mine in New Jersey waited until one of the local kleptocrats was about to be sent to jail, went by and paid him $1 million for his farm under the table. The guy put it in Bermuda. He got a farm that was worth a lot more just before the guy went to jail because he was able to hide the money from him. So unless you get a deal like that, you know, if you find a deal like that, you know, look for the financiers that are sent to jail and make a deal with them. But if you can't find a financier like that, better stay out of the market. When everybody thinks the prices are going to go down, that's usually the time to buy because most people are always wrong. And if you go against what everybody believes, you're sure to be have the same timing as the smart boys.
How do you know when you're hitting the bottom?
You never do. You never do until it's actually hit. You never know until after the upturn comes. And there's a phrase on Wall Street, bulls make money, in other words, optimists make money, bears make money, pigs don't make money. The smart guys always wait until it turns up and then they get in. They don't try to hit the bottom because there's no way of knowing how bad things can get or how good things are get. You always wait for the turning point and then you jump in. That's why after the turning point, things are always so sharp going either up or down.
What's the difference between bonds and CDs?
The trouble with buying a bond, a CD is a short term. A bond, if you expect the interest rates are now as low as they can go, that means that when interest rates rise, bond prices are going to go down. So I don't see any way that bond prices can go lower than they are now, so I'd stay away from bonds. High-income stocks, that's called the Dow dogs. You buy the Dow Jones average that have the highest yield, but these are usually the companies that are not growing, like you can get a lot of money on General Motors. That pays a high dividend, but it's about to go bankrupt. So it's so much of a gamble that all the people I know are afraid of the risk. If you're buying an income-yielding stock these days, that means the income's just before the collapse comes, and yes, you'll get more income, but you're going to lose all your capital. And that's most people don't like to do that.
Would you classify yourself as an optimist or pessimist?
I'm very optimistic. I think society's going to collapse and a new world's going to come into being.
Why have stocks been going up when housing is going down?
About a month ago, the Secretary of the Treasury organized what he's called the Plunge Protection Team. And before he goes to China, he got all the Wall Street bankers to agree to flood the market with credit, bolster it up so that he could convince foreign countries to make various diplomatic deals with America, including the Iranian arrangement. And it's very temporary. It's being artificially supported. But it's about to go. As the dollar goes down, you're going to have all the foreigners that have been buying the American stock sell because a dollar-denominated stock is going to go down with everything else that's denominated in dollars. So it's being artificially supported for political reasons. But there's no economic justification for
it. Is the war in Iraq going to bankrupt the United States?
No, because it's all been paid for by China. And America has no intention at all of paying the $1 trillion in foreign debt that the government owes because it doesn't have $1 trillion to pay. What? Nothing to worry about. They can always print the money. They owe it to foreigners in dollars, and the advantage of owing money to foreign governments is dollars. You control the printing press. Nobody ever went bankrupt for the money that they owed. They got money trying to repay it, and America's too smart to repay it. I've written books on this topic. That's why the Secretary of the Treasury says the dollar is your problem, not ours. It's our deficit, your problem. What are you going to do about it?
Is the war good for the economy?
It's good for the arms industry. It's bad for the rest of the economy. It's bad for the workers, good for the arms manufacturers. Good for people with good political contacts. Good for the insiders and the lobbyists. Good for the alcohol makers. The death rate is beginning to go up. Alcoholism rate's going up. So it's good for the tobacco companies, the liquor companies, and the drug manufacturers, basically.
Do you think we're heading for a depression?
That seems to be what most people believe, but they'll call it wealth formation. So they won't call it a depression. They'll have nicer, new euphemisms for it. But already, we're in a situation where people are having to spend most of their... If you're entering the home market today, you have to spend the rest of your life working to pay off the mortgage to buy high-priced property. That's hell. That would have been considered a depression 40 years ago. We're in a position that other countries would have thought was an absolute disaster, if not feudalism. So I call it neo-serfdom. That's probably better than calling it a depression, because I don't think the world goes in cycles. I think it's changing all the time. Let's say neo-serfdom. Absentee-owned property is going to be put up for sale. Property that people live in, they're going to keep living in it. They're not going to sell it. The lower income you are, the more you're going to keep your property until it's foreclosed upon.